I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's July 4th, a holiday where we celebrate independence and the creation of a democratic nation. Democratic and stable are adjectives the U.S. hoped would describe Iraq after the U.S. invasion there. And many Iraqis imagined that after all they went through, they'd end up with a peaceful nation. Right now, though, that seems very far off. The militant Sunni group ISIS, or the Islamic State, as it now wants to be known, has been steamrolling across large parts of Iraq and killing people in its path. Today, we turn to David Patel to help us reflect on what's happening there. He's a Middle East scholar at Brandeis University, and he spent a lot of time living and studying in Iraq. He told me that for someone like him, what's been happening there comes as little surprise.
I think a lot of Americans had tuned out of what was happening in Iraq for the past couple of years. I think the Arab Spring and events elsewhere in the Middle East had taken over, in general, burnout of what was happening. But those of us who are still focused on Iraq, things have been getting very bad for a long time now. Since 2009, 2010, there's been a steady decline in security in many parts of Iraq, and violence was off the charts for the past year. So this attention is now back on Iraq because of ISIS, but things have been very bad there for quite some time now.
Now, we have this group ISIS, or the Islamic State. They're kind of making their way, pushing their way south in a very violent, brutal way. They're edging toward Baghdad. They're near one of cities, Samarra, that has sacred sites. And I know these Shia sacred sites are something you've written a lot about. Tell us about these sacred sites and why they're so important.
Well, there's four major ones for Shias in Iraq. The two major ones are south of Baghdad in the Shia heartland, Najaf and Karbala. And those are really the central shrines and contain the graves of the two most important figures in post-Muhammad Shia history. The one that's most threatened right now, though, is Samarra, which is up north. It's between Tikrit and Baghdad. And so it's really on the front lines of this ISIS-Iraqi government confrontation. And so one way of thinking about ISIS targeting the shrines is actually taking over territory that includes the shrines. Samarra is right in there, is right in that category now. The other way of being a target are attempts by ISIS to blow up the shrine or attack the shrine in order to start a sectarian war, which is their goal. They've said that's their goal. Their predecessor organizations in Iraq made that their goal and achieved it back in February 2006 when they attacked that shrine in Samarra in February of that year. So one is them trying to take over territory that happens to include those shrines. The second is actually targeting those shrines in order to provoke retaliation on Sunnis within the country.
Now, let's go to Samarra. Take us there. If we went to Samarra today to this shrine, what would we see and who would be there?
Well, I imagine what you'd see would be tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers and volunteers, probably many of them Shias from outside Iraq as well, guarding the shrine and trying to prevent ISIS.
And what is
ISIS.
The shrine? What would we see?
So you'd see a giant gold dome over a tomb. And so in Samarra, it's called the Askariya Shrine, and it contains the graves of two of the 12 imams, the 10th and 11th imams. And next to it is also a place where the 12th imam, the Mahdi, the Messiah, went into occultation, where he removed himself from earth. He's not dead. So it's not his grave. And so this is really core for Shia belief. This is where the Mahdi left earth. And everything in Shia politics today is about how you govern the world in the absence of this just ruler, the Mahdi, right? The Iranian government is based on the idea that the cleric should be running thing until he returns. This site is inextricably linked to the Mahdi and to those two of those 12 other imams.
Okay, take us further south then to Najaf. And Karbala, what are the shrines there and what do pilgrims do when they go?
Oh, it's an amazing experience. So those shrines in Najaf and Karbala, where the most venerated imams are buried, those were the commemorations of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who died in 680. It's really that moment is really central for what it means to be a Shia. Let me take you to Karbala. The two enormous shrines, about a football-sized field each, with a large open space between them. And the shrines have a huge gold dome over a very elaborate sarcophagus with gold plating, silver plating all around it. And people will be running back and forth, large pilgrimages groups. You'll hear people speaking Arabic, but different Arabic accents, some Lebanese, some Iraqi accents, some Bahraini accents. You'll see Iranians there speaking Farsi. There'll be Indian pilgrims there. There'll be pilgrims from Detroit, Michigan, from Nigeria, visiting these shrines. And when you go into the building themselves, the emotion that people have is just simply overwhelming.
And is it men and women or just men?
Men and women both, but they'll be segregated in separate areas. And so I've been in the areas with the men. And what you really are overcome by is the grief and the empathetic experience of solidarity that these pilgrims have with the Imam's pain. And these are grown men who've fought in a number of wars, who've worked their whole lives, working class and rich side by side, wailing hysterically oftentimes.
Really?
Absolutely.
It's, are there certain kind of smells and feel that you feel when you go to these shrines, or incense?
Incense, certainly. But since 2003, the number of people has just been overwhelming. These cities have been booming. This is, aside from Kurdistan, this is probably the area that has grown and developed the most.
This is Najaf and Karbala.
Najaf and Karbala.
Give me a sense of if ISIS or Islamic State, if they attacked one of these shrines, say in Najaf or Karbala, I mean, is it conceivable that that could happen?
Well, in February 2006, the way they were able to blow up a large part of the shrine in Samarra, where insurgents, Al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time, at the time they called themselves Al-Qaeda in the Land of the Two Rivers, the predecessor of ISIS, they snuck some guys in dressed in Iraqi military uniforms. And they got in there, tied up the Iraqi police and soldiers guarding the shrine and planted the bombs. So they were able to infiltrate it. And I think the fear is, with so many volunteers coming, with so many people, so many militias, and so many clerics and political organizations around Iraq sending militias and volunteers there to quote-unquote defend the shrine, the fear is that ISIS will be able to sneak in some suicide bombers or some people with bombs posing as defenders of the shrine. And so I think that among Shia groups that are defending the shrines now, that's the real concern.
As Iraq moves forward, here we are on July 4th, celebrating the independence of a nation, and we kind of have some clear boundaries of what that nation is. If you could imagine a future Iraq that might be celebrating its own independence or its own new future, what do those borders look like?
I think it's hard to have a conversation about what the future borders of Iraq will look like without looking at the larger regional picture. This conflict that's going on, and I say this conflict because now the conflicts in Syria and Iraq have merged, I think this is going to go on for at least another decade. And so I think we need to ask this question again in a decade. If Syria will still have the same borders it has, if Iraq will still have the same borders that it has, if what Kurdistan looks like, the entire political order in the Middle East in many ways is being challenged by what's going on right now.
David, I know you spent a lot of time in Iraq, living there and studying there. Who in Iraq are you thinking about?
Today in particular, I'm thinking about a friend, Ghufran Ahmed. He's probably about 39, 40 years old now. Don't remember exactly when his birthday was. He lived in Mosul, doesn't come from a wealthy family, but he was able to come to the United States, get a master's in archaeology from Stony Brook, and he went back and was teaching at Mosul University after 2009, teaching prehistory. He's Iraq's first prehistorian, and he had to flee Mosul when ISIS took over. He, his wife, and his two daughters are now in Iraqi Kurdistan. He's stuck there. He doesn't know anyone there. He doesn't have any connections, and he can't return home. If he does, he'll be killed almost immediately. So I'm thinking an awful lot about Ghufran today, not just about where he is today, but what the next decade of his life is going to look like in his daughters' lives.
That's David Patel, a research fellow at the Crown Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University.